top secret. For senior officer. Immediate. Decipher and pass to all relevant sections. 3rd of April. Intelligence Insight, number 002.
Welcome to this Bletchley Park Intelligence Insight. In this episode, we're going to take you back to 2017. That year was the centenary of a relatively little-known genius who went straight from studying mathematics at Cambridge to code-breaking for the Government Code and Cipher School. The crucial role that Bill Tutte played in the attack on the system that Hitler and his high command used, Lorenz, not only broke it, but also helped pave the way for the creation of the world's first large-scale digital computer, Colossus. Bill finally now receives the recognition he richly deserved. In 2017, there was a BBC documentary about him. At Bletchley Park, we opened a major exhibition about him. And on the actual day of his centenary, we held a symposium of talks about his life and work. When we originally put that episode out, we could only really include sort of 5-minute, 10-minute highlights from each of the talks, just due to the number of people who'd spoken. So I'm really pleased that we can bring you the entire talk and question and answer session from that day from GCHQ's shortly-to-retire departmental historian Tony Comer. Tony decided in his talk that he'd look at some of the fundamental changes that had happened at GCNCS that basically allowed Bill to carry out his breathtaking achievements. After the talk, we've decided to include the interview we recorded last year with Tony at the National Arboretum. It was a nice opportunity to look back at his career and also to exclusively introduce his replacement. But before that, we'll go back to the Bill Tutte Symposium in 2017, where Catherine Lynch caught up with Tony before his talk.
It's a glorious morning. The sun is shining on the trees at Bletchley Park. And before we get going for a day of learning all about the fascinating character that was Bill Tutte, we've press-ganged the GCHQ departmental historian, Tony Comer, for a chat about the talk you're going to give and some interesting things that are coming up at GCHQ as well. First of all, welcome back to Bletchley Park, because you probably come here more often than we do. It's a special day today, isn't it?
It is. It's really good that Bill Tutte is being, as it were, formally recognised as being part of the pantheon at Bletchley Park. For many years, and for understandable reasons, the work that he did wasn't discussed in public. And to a certain extent, his contribution has been overshadowed in the public imagination by the amount of attention that's been paid to Alan Turing. But I think work in recent years, for example, Joel Greenberg's biography of Gordon Welshman, today's ceremony and other ceremonies that have taken place celebrating the work of Bill Tutte, we're beginning to get to a point where we can actually show that there are a variety of people who worked here at Bletchley Park who were absolute geniuses and whose contribution was incredibly valuable.
In a way, it could be seen as almost helpful that the amount of attention Alan Turing got a handful of years ago, what with the centenary and then the film, because once there is almost a household name and somebody that people are generally aware of and, you know, the incredible achievements he made and his tragic story kind of helped push that forward, you've got a chink into people's consciousness, haven't you? You say, if you're interested in that story, you'd also want to hear about this guy. You know, then it opens up, doesn't it? And like you say, Gordon Welshman and now Bill Tutte.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it's one of the reasons why I think, unlike quite a few intelligence historians, I refuse to get very sniffy about films like The Imitation Game. It's not a documentary, it's a drama. You know, Hollywood makes blockbuster movies to make a lot of money, but what it's done is reawakened interest, and it's awoken interest in a new generation. And the other part of it is it doesn't diminish the stature of Alan Turing to talk about some of the other people. So I've mentioned today we're talking about Bill Tutte. Bill Tutte couldn't have recovered what he did in Tunney, except for the work that John Tiltman had done before him in actually breaking out the first Tunney encrypted message. If it hadn't been for Tommy Flowers subsequently, there wouldn't have been a production line of intelligence from teleprinter. It isn't as though there's a fixed number of brownie points and everybody's scrabbling over who gets how many. The more we discover about these people, the more we appreciate both their individual brilliance and the way in which they actually worked together as a team during the war.
in a way, when people say that they've made great achievements, they say, I'm standing on the shoulders of giants. They all were in some way, weren't they? Because everybody's work fed from what went before. And you can keep going back. And like you say, it's this ever-expanding sort of web of all these people that came together to achieve this incredible success that was here during the war.
You're absolutely right. And the bit that people sometimes forget about is they were able to do that because of the work that had gone on between the wars that built on the tremendous success that had happened during World War One. I would also look then and say, and how was that taken forward post-1945 into Cold War GCHQ and right through? We're going to say rather more. Over the next couple of years, we've commissioned an authorised history, and we will be working with the Science Museum on a big exhibition, which will, I think, hopefully demystify a lot of the things we do, but actually give people the opportunity to see what happened after 1945 and perhaps play with some of the gadgets that post-date Enigma and Tunny and the sort of things that people can see at Bletchley.
Tony, you must have done some fascinating research building up to what you're going to talk about today. What's really stood out for you that will stay with you about Built Up?
I think the unassuming nature of somebody who'd come from a humble background, had got scholarships to go through school, to grammar school, to university. He had only come across maths almost by chance. He was a natural scientist. He was studying chemistry and just got fascinated by maths and was noted by people here and invited to come and join. I don't think anybody really knew him, and I don't think anybody could have expected that he'd make such a crucial individual contribution to the work that happened here. And then after the war, he gently drifted out of public consciousness. And I think just the thing that sticks with me is here's yet another example of people who very few people have ever heard of, and they're being brought back into public attention.
Made a huge contribution. Enjoy talking to everyone today, and I'm sure some people will come to you with some more fascinating questions later.
Thanks very much.
Very delighted to welcome Tony Comer to the stage. Thank you, Tony.
Right, morning everybody. It's a great honour really to be here on Built Up's birthday. It's a tremendous link, I think, for all of us to be able to think back to such a seminal character and somebody whose genius actually led to a series of intelligence triumphs that were crucial in the defeat of the Germans in the West. What I want to do today is look at some of the technical problems around. Thank you. Look at some technical problems, you see, they're always with us. I want to look at some of the technical problems around the collection and the processing of Tunny Intercept, and then take a step back and look at how the organisation that came here in 1939 had to be transformed by the technology that it was trying to defeat. Ordinary teleprinter being broadcast by wireless had been seen from the early 1930s, but it wasn't a particular concern for the Government Code and Cipher School, the organisation that would come here in 1939. And that was because it had its own flow of material, a system whereby a member of staff went round to each of the telegraph companies every morning, picked up all of the diplomatic correspondence that was being carried and took it to the Code and Cipher School at that time at 54 Broadway in London for processing. In the years after 1919, this flow of material led to an organisation that was very successful in producing vast quantities of diplomatic intelligence, but which had started to ignore the fact, first of all, that the primary targets that it would need to face in wartime were military, and secondly, the technological limitations of a collection capability that was expecting that wanted intercept would be transmitted on high frequency in Morse code.
So it was in fact the Metropolitan Police who had an experimental interception site at Denmark Hill in London, whose principal target was Soviet agents in the UK, Soviet agents who would be receiving from and sending to Moscow traffic. And the job at Denmark Hill was to look for unusual and strange signals. And they were the people who first actually heard in 1930 the first experimental teleprinter signals, and were the first to report in 1932 that a link had been established between Berlin and Moscow. But there was no collection of this system whatsoever. It meant that when the first experimental Tunney transmissions were seen in 1940, and even more importantly, when in mid-1941 the Vienna to Athens Tunney link was established, that the capability actually to process this material with any sort of guarantee of success was very limited. Claire explained about Tiltman's great success in comparing the two very similar messages and allowing subsequently Bill Tutt to work out how the key was generated in the machines. But this knowledge by itself was of little immediate value. They'd worked out that the German operators who were using this machine weren't actually involved in any of the encipherment. They worked out the problem of the number of wheels and what the wheels were for. But by itself, this information was of little value. The fact that the statistical methods that were required to actually recover settings on the machine, once the indicator system changed and there was no obvious way of working out how the machine had been set up, other than by doing statistical methods, led to a requirement by the cryptanalysts to have pieces of absolutely faithful intercept. And this was a tremendous problem. Firstly, because the German transmitters that were sending these messages were not obviously optimized so that they could be heard clearly in the United Kingdom. Their aim was to make sure, for example, that a signal sent from Athens could be heard in Vienna, not in Kent. And so there were always going to be problems with sending and receiving the messages. It wasn't a question, for example, of putting a teleprinter alongside the receivers in the UK. The teleprinters available until a supply of modern teleprinters started to come from the United States in the latter part of 1943. Teleprinters in the UK weren't good enough. They hadn't got sufficient quality to be able to guarantee to reproduce the teleprinter signals that the Germans were sending on the air. And in fact, the only really clear way of guaranteeing to collect this material properly was to use undulator tape to represent pictorially the type of signal that was being sent. Whether it was a dot or an X would be represented in a different way on pieces of photographic paper. You sometimes hear elderly people complaining about the fact that during the Second World War, they had a real hobby of photography. It was very difficult to get photographic paper. It's because of this place. This is where all of the quantities of paper that could be produced, they had the first choice of. So what would happen when a Tunney message was intercepted? First of all, you would try to intercept it on two separate machines by two separate operators. And then the two pieces of intercept would be compared against the undulator tape so that a clean version of the signal could be prepared. And then this was sent from the intercept site by 1942. It had moved from Denmark Hill to Knockholt outside Sevenoaks. And then it had to be sent to Bletchley, but it had to be sent by two separate landlines. It had to be sent by landline so the Germans wouldn't know that their signals were being intercepted. But even in the landlines, the quality of the signal would degrade sufficiently that there wasn't a clean version available from either source. And so here at Bletchley, the two different signals from the interception site had to be compared. And this was because part of the statistical run meant looking at this 5,000 character long tape and comparing it at successive positions. After the first run through 5,000 characters, they'd start again, but at the second character and then at the third. It meant that every mistake wasn't just one mistake, but it was magnified, because on every repetition of the system, another mistake would be inserted into the decryption process. The point I'm trying to make is that working at the sharp end, the sharpest end of technology, at the time when Bill Tutt was carrying out his extraordinary feat of research and diagnosis of how the machine worked, was incredibly difficult because of the neglect of any sort of exploration of developing technology that there'd been in the 1930s, and because of the enormous expansion of Bletchley Park, which had led to a whole series of problems which would bedevil the work of signals intelligence here. I said the organisation had concentrated pretty well entirely on diplomatic intelligence before the war. It was a very small organisation. By August 1939, there were 200 people in the Government Code and Cipher School. It was founded on the 1st of November 1919 with 96 people. It had just about doubled in size by 1939. In 6 years, the number just at Bletchley Park would rise to 10,000, with another 20,000 people at outstations around the country. There was a total change in the organisation. There was a total change in its structures. The organisation that came to Bletchley in August 1939, for example, had no HR function. For most people working in any large organisation in the UK today, the idea that there was no HR, there were no appraisals, there was nobody actually looking on a day-to-day basis on how work was carried out might sound very attractive. The best example of this comes actually in 1939, as the organisation was preparing to come to Bletchley Park. Tiltman had recruited an ex-colleague of his from days in Simla, a Chinese linguist called Jeffrey, to come and join the organisation. And Jeffrey was very dismissive of the elderly members of the Japanese consular service who'd been recruited into the Code and Cipher School as Japanese linguists. One in particular they needed to get rid of. They didn't know that civil servants could be sacked. It was assumed that a civil servant was a civil servant until he retired. Admiral Sinclair, the head of SIS and responsible for the Code and Cipher School, came to the magisterial decision that he would have him sectioned, as that would be the best way to get him out of the picture. A very, very creative approach to human resources, you must admit. It's a microcosm of the problems that the organisation was going to have. An organisation that was small enough to be managed by A.G. Denniston, somebody who could know all of the members of his staff, somebody who was capable of inspiring them to their best work, couldn't cope with the organisation that came here and began to expand. An organisation that had dealt, as I say, exclusively with what was known as slip, the output of telegraphic tape, people to read it and copy it out, was finding it increasingly difficult to deal with technology. The service elements that came to Bletchley Park, again, what had been a very civilian organisation, came to Bletchley Park and at first even lost completely those military sections that it had, which returned to the service ministries in London. As the service elements built up again in 1940 and 1941, their own requirements, their own tensions began to take over in the way that arguments happened about prioritisation. There was no single scheme that looked at the prioritisation of interception across all of the service stations and the Foreign Office stations, which also contributed. It was a very difficult time. And in January 1942, after a report by Brigadier Van Cutsem into the organisation of Bletchley Park, Stuart Mingies, the head of SIS, took the decision to get Denniston to recreate the diplomatic service that he had run between the wars and leave Bletchley Park to focus on the production of military intelligence against the Axis. And he gave the role of managing Bletchley Park to the man who'd been Denniston's deputy, Commander Travis, known as Jumbo to his friends, who was somebody who had an extensive network amongst the military and who, unbeknown to Sir Stuart Menzies, had his own vision of how Bletchley should grow and be organised to cope with all of the challenges that he was facing. A year into his job, in February 1943, he wrote what he called a domestic document. It sounds very innocuous, but it was in fact revolutionary because it revealed for the first time his plan or his thinking about how signals intelligence should be structured, how it should be managed. Domestic meant that for the first time, a significant policy document wasn't going to be shared with the head of the Secret Intelligence Service. Travis already saw that signals intelligence, as it grew and developed, would need to sever its formal organisational ties with the human intelligence organisation, MI6, that was being run by Menzies. Travis looked back at the organisation he'd inherited and broke down really into four categories, the areas where there were problems. The first was the problem of interception. There were interception sites, but the radios that were being used, the technology of the radios, had been very mixed, and it was only the fact that US industry was beginning to produce large numbers of HRO receivers that was beginning to get the interception sites onto a good technological footing. Just as important, however, during 1942 had been the reinforcement by the Y Committee of an organisation which began to look at tasking interception sites from the centre, from Bletchley, as one single piece of work. What is known in the jargon as counterpartism, the idea, for example, that Royal Air Force collection sites should only collect against air targets, had to be broken down and was broken down essentially in 1942, with collection management being something that became focused and concentrated. But even then, it was a battle. The idea that the service intelligence authorities still had, which was that the job of Bletchley Park was simply to provide keys to cryptanalysis, but that all subsequent work would be done in the intelligence divisions of the service ministries, was one that missed on the whole need to unify traffic analysis with cryptanalysis. It was only by using his extensive network of contacts that Travis was able, during 1942, to have the Army's, what they call their intelligence schools, their traffic analysis units, brought to Bletchley Park so that the traffic analysis and crypt analysis could be unified as part of an intelligence production process here. Travis had found that though he probably had adequate numbers of cryptanalysts, they weren't being used to their best. There were a small number of the cryptanalysts working against teleprint targets, for example, who had the new challenging fish targets to work against. You had the people doing the work against the variants of Enigma, but they were totally dependent on the material that was being sent to them. And again, Travis realised that he needed technologists, that the cryptanalysts by themselves were not going to be able to provide anything unless the technology that was being used at the interception sites and in the forwarding of material to Bletchley Park was adequate. And of course, technologists were in very short supply. The deal that Travis did to ensure a supply of specialists from the post office was critical in the success of the organisation as a whole. As I said earlier, today it would seem incredible that anyone would question that Bletchley Park was an intelligence centre. But it's one of the complaints of the people who'd worked in Room 40 and in MI1B during the First World War, that when they came back to work for the organisation in 1939 and 1940, that it had forgotten how to do intelligence. The diplomatic reporting that was done by the Code and Cipher School between the wars wasn't really intelligence production at all. It was simply a churning out of decrypted messages and an expectation that people in the Foreign Office would actually try to make sense of what was being done and what was going on. But the sheer quantity of material being handled here, the added value that traffic analysis was providing to the interpretation of decrypted messages meant that Bletchley Park was only going to work successfully if it became an intelligence organisation and, in Travis's view, if it became an integrated signals intelligence organisation working separately from other intelligence organisations. And his final note was on administration, that an administrative structure had been created, an organisation called the Joint Control Committee, which was to look at the way that everything in Bletchley Park was managed, had been created, but it was only responsible for administration and didn't include anybody who was actually involved on the intelligence production side of the organisation. He saw the need to restructure his senior management so that he could ensure that the administration of the people who worked in the organisation could be integrated with the administration of the production of intelligence. Travis saw in the technology that this was going to be the key to the success of the organisation, and so paid personal attention, for example, to the tabulating section. The tabulating section had barely existed as a separate unit before he became head at Bletchley Park. The tabulating section for large parts of 1941 had been responsible for lots of boxes in which undismantled equipment had been left because there was nobody actually to work on it. So he'd actually put a lot of effort into making sure that the tabulating section could be housed properly and that it could actually be the capability generator that would underpin the work of as many different sections of work in Bletchley Park as could be, all the way from the machines being used in decrypting enciphered teleprinter right through to the communications section, the area that was disseminating the intelligence that was being produced. The idea that there should be a unified control of the technology that was needed to make the organisation work was a particular inspiration of his, and also the involvement in that work of Tiltman as chief cryptographer, that his view was that if the organisation was only going to work if the cryptanalysis could be properly sourced by good collection and could be properly disseminated through channels, that the chief crypt analyst had to be involved in the work that was being done. And his other great investment was in the research section. His view was that in the same way as in medicine, that if you don't have sound diagnosis at the start of the examination of a problem, you aren't going to get a good solution to that problem, was one that he saw as self-evident, but one that hadn't been the case before he took charge. His view as he looked forward was of an organisation that would continue to grow because they had the necessary elements in place. They had, in terms of the Axis powers, insight into Tunny, which was the system by which the German High Command organised its work. They had the insights into Enigma, which gave them detail of the operational capabilities and intentions of the German armed forces. They were at the point working with the Americans, of being able to say that four rotor bombs would now be able to be constructed on both sides of the Atlantic. He saw that by bringing these together and by properly coordinating the way that all elements of the work at Bletchley Park and at the outstations that served Bletchley were carried out, the organisation could reach the pitch of being able to look across the entirety of the communications of the Axis powers and produce intelligence. He ended his note to his senior staff by stating this succinctly. If we were asked to cut the cackle and make a brief statement of our aims and our beliefs, it would be this. We believe that we should try to read every enemy signal, neglecting none, however apparently unimportant. We believe in the unholy trinity of interception, cryptography, and intelligence. And we believe that communications have been the secret of the German success in this war and might be ours. What he'd done was laid the foundation on which would be built the success in the build-up to D-Day, and also to lay the foundations for signals intelligence as an industrial scale organisation instead of the cottage industry it had been before the Second World War. Thank you very much.
So if anyone's got any questions, just put your hands up and I'll bring a microphone to you.
How did they know the original signals that they used to crack the Lawrence Code? How did they know they were the same signal that were, or the same message that was being transmitted?
On the particular example, it was because the message was going from Athens to Vienna, and at the receiving end in Vienna, they asked for the message to be resent. They'd not managed to receive it properly, and so simply asked for a resend. And put simply, the person in Athens who was sending the message was a bit cheesed off at having to type this long message out again, and so he tried to do it in more of a hurry the second time. I think that's probably a gross simplification, but it's a rightish.
Can I go right back to the move from Broadway to Bletchley Park, the establishment and move in 39? There's a much published photograph of a group of gents called Captain Ridley's shooting party. Do you know, or from your archives, the names of individuals in that group? And when was it? Captain Ridley, I understand, was in naval intelligence, but I might be wrong in that. But is there any evidence that it actually happened? This photograph, you know, we don't know when it was taken, really, when it was there. Is there any evidence in the archives of this party of people and what they did and who was responsible for the decision to move to Bletchley Park?
There are two different things going on. There is the famous photograph of people arriving. There's some discussion about whether that is a picture of what happened in 1938, when during the Munich crisis, there was the first test use of Bletchley Park as a war centre. And don't forget, this is for SIS as well as for the Code and Cipher School. This was the place that SIS would come to in wartime as well. I don't know whether it's 1938 or 1939. As far as the 1939 move goes, all of our records are in the National Archives now. They're available to anybody to look at, and there are full lists of the people who were sent. There are lists saying what class travel. First class, if your salary is £1,000 a year or more, third class otherwise. And there are billeting lists that show exactly where people were billeted when they arrived on the 16th of August, 1939. So there is a lot of information about exactly who travelled when and where. There's also the, I can't remember what it's called, there was a sort of census-like thing in 1939 that was taken as part of the government's way of working out who would be eligible to be called up under conscription. And that one is now available. It's available online through one of the genealogical sites. And it's very interesting to see the number of people around this part of Buckinghamshire who declare that their employer is MI6. They had It was a good cover story to hide the fact that they were actually from the Code and Cipher School. But they were quite open about saying that they were from MI6 in various of the billeting hotels and pubs that they were billeted at. So there is actually quite a lot of information out there, but I don't think anyone's made a systematic go at it yet.
How would they go about advertising for, you know, the new recruits who came in? As you said, they grew from 96 people into a 10,000 people organization. So where they worked in had to be kept in secret. So how did they go about hiring people?
Between the wars, posts were advertised because it was called the Government Code and Cipher School. It took 20 years for anyone to realize that that might give the game away a bit about what the organization was for. Its main cover story was that, and it's not just a cover story, it's part of its responsibilities, as a part of GCHQ's responsibilities are today, is about protecting government codes and ciphers. They advertised, you can find in the National Archives, you can find the annual competition, find the test papers that people did. You had to be basically a linguist who was good at arithmetic. That was for the cryptanalysts. Below them, there were a range of clerical linguist posts, and they tended just to be people who were recruited by recommendation. So you knew somebody. The wife of Bill Bonsall, who was a famous person who worked here, and she had joined because she spoke Italian. Her uncle was an MI6 officer who worked in Italy. And before he was expelled by Mussolini, she used to go and spend the summer at her uncle's, and she'd learned Italian. So when the Code and Cipher School needed some Italian linguists, this chap was able to say, oh, my niece could do that job. And that was the recommendation. Of course, that turned over completely during the war. And between directed labour and simple adverts, again, I saw one just recently from 1943, an advert that was looking for girls who speak German and who are prepared to do secret work. And they were recruited in their tens and in their hundreds. Some of the language used in recruitment posts, again, wouldn't meet modern HR standards.
A person who worked alongside Travis before the war was in room 40 and was Travis's right-hander right through the period he was in command at Bletchley Park. And then after the war was Nigel de Grey. How crucial was he in the changes that Travis brought about?
Nigel de Grey is perhaps one of the least well-known of the people who worked here at Bletchley Park, and one of the crucial ones, because his post, I think I've got it written down here somewhere, was quite deliberately set up to be Travis's right-hand man, to actually worry about the detail of the problems that Travis had identified, to be the head when Travis was away, when he was travelling or anything like that, but just to make sure he had no real responsibilities other than to do as Travis asked. But he was the deputy. It's interesting that he's one of the people who worked in Room 40 during the First World War, left after the war, went back into a commercial art printing company, was called back and was one of the ones who was quite horrified at how the organisation had effectively shrunk from what it had been during the war. He was probably one of the motors of change before Travis's appointment. Tiltman left in his memoirs basically a tally of who was loyal to Denniston and who was disloyal. And de Grey certainly, as far as Tiltman was concerned, ranked pretty high in the disloyalty stakes. I think it's unfair as a way of looking at it. Denniston wasn't capable of managing the organisation that was developing here. And it's interesting, you know, the head of MI5, since the time of the First World War, he was sacked in 1940. The head of SIS died in 1939, but was replaced, obviously had to be replaced. The people who'd worked in intelligence between the wars hadn't got really the capability to run the large organisations that developed. And I think de Grey was very much the right person to support Travis.
Tony, in my own readings at Kew, I've come across in the director's files references in 1940 to BQ. Now, Bletchley Park, of course, was under, well, Britain, should I say, was under risk of invasion at the time. And this, from what I could gather, was a team who were going to move away from Bletchley, head north. There are letters there about what cars would be used, who was going to go, how it was going to be organised. But at the same time, it's nothing that I've ever come across in a book. Perhaps I'm reading the wrong ones. And I'm wondering if you could add anything.
There were definite plans that were drawn up in May and June of 1940. And certainly a lot of the records were farmed out. Believe it or not, I think it was the National Westminster Bank, or whatever it was called in those days, in Pontypridd, in South Wales, for example, its vaults became the archive for Bletchley Park for a while until they could be sent to Canada. You're right about people who had been identified who partly shouldn't be captured by the Germans. It was important that the secrecy of what they were doing shouldn't get out. But their job was to move, in the case of invasion, northwards and westwards towards Greenock, where they would end up getting on board a Royal Navy ship, which would take them to Canada. And it would be from Canada that the work of the Code and Cipher School would continue were Britain to be invaded and occupied. Where's it written down? As you say, in the National Archives at Kew, there's about 3 or 4% of the material that's been released that anybody ever bothers to look at and use. So any of you sort of looking for an interesting hobby, there is loads and loads and loads of material just begging to be written up.
Thank you. I mean, we hear a lot about Bletchley Park, but on the German side, there must have been quite a sophisticated organisation to develop things like the Lorenz. You know, can you comment about their side of it and what they were doing and how they were evolving during the war?
German technology was and is highly sophisticated. And all the way through the war, the Germans continued to invest in R&D. The bits that we're most concerned about are on things like communication systems. I found recently the first piece of real fax intercept. You know, the Germans developed a system called the Hellschreiber, which was a primitive precursor to facsimile. But the first sort of recognisable fax in terms of interception that we've got comes from 1944, when the Germans find that the best way, as the Americans began to bomb the home islands, what the Germans were sending was a pictorial description of how a US Army Air Force bombing raid would happen, how the different squadrons and wings would be organised. And they developed a fax system to do this so they could use high frequency to send these images. It's why the development of Knockholt was so important and why Travis put such an effort into his experimental and research station was of necessity. It was because of German development of telecommunications technology.
I wonder if you could say something about how Travis's organisation and ethos, which you outlined so well, has fed forward into modern GCHQ.
How long have we got? It's very much Travis's organisation, and some of the problems that were caused by moving Denniston and his party to Berkeley Street in London actually survived as reflections right into the 1990s. The real effects of Bletchley Park on modern GCHQ are far too many to relate. But the way in which Travis changed, the way in which he industrialised intelligence production, the way in which work against the Soviet target in the Cold War mirrored the work against the Axis target during the Second World War, all of these fed through. And if you can just wait a couple of years, we have an authorised history, which we've now commissioned and which is in preparation and which will be published. And we'll go into more detail about how the organisation during the Second World War grew out of what had happened here at Bletchley.
How sensitive are GCHQ about the history of traffic analysis during the wartime and that history?
I don't know if you've been primed by the legion of people who keep writing to me saying, are you going to review and release the history of SICSTA? And the answer is, there we are. Yes, we are. It's a question simply of it getting to the top of the release pile.
Thank you very much, Tony. If everyone would like to give Tony a round of applause.
Over the entire life of the podcast, we've had the amazing help of GCHQ's official historian, who these days I can call Tony Comer, but originally could only say was the historian, and that was it. It seems somewhat fitting that the last time we will have him on the podcast is from today's event. Tony, what did today mean to you?
It meant a series of things. It meant an end to the centenary year, an end to all of the work that we've put in to celebrating 100 years of GCHQ. It means an end to 3 or 4 years of more or less detailed planning. It means, for me, a sort of end to my career on a really high note as we go out with a sort of blaze of positive publicity about what the organisation's for and what it does. And I suppose also it's a thing about the start of the next 100 years. And one of the things that you've been lucky enough to hear today is a bunch of very young junior members of staff who, I must admit, are as inspiring to me as our predecessors are.
As Betty Webb was saying in the interview that I've done with Betty, she herself was really proud of those, what she called young people, and was surprised how young they were. I did have to point out to her that she was only 18 when she started at Bletchley, so it's a similar thing. For someone who's coming up to retirement, as you are, most people wind down. I'd imagine this last year's been probably one of your busiest years ever, hasn't it?
It's been extremely busy. It's involved a lot of media stuff. It's involved a lot of public speaking. I felt a bit like Frank Sinatra doing a round-the-world farewell tour. I've got more stamps in my passport for the United States for this year than I have probably for the last 4 years put together. And it has been busy, but I've been very lucky because since June, my successor has been on board. GCHQ have been incredibly good by allowing us a 14-month handover. So while I have been very busy, I can actually say that not only is the end in sight, but I've got somebody to whom I can hand over this job and be quite content that I'm leaving it in hands that are more than capable of taking the job forward and transforming it into something new.
And that's the perfect point to introduce the man himself.
Hello. So my name's David Abreu-Tutt. I joined GCHQ in 2002. Prior to that, I've spent many years in academia and in the military. I've spent most of my career in GCHQ working in operations, and I'm very passionate about our organisation, what binds us together, what makes us tick, and the history is very much part of that. And the iconic history that we've got with Bletchley Park and World War II is very much in the public gaze, but we've got such a rich history as being displayed today with our centenary celebration at the Arboretum.
We've only met a few times, but already I can tell the passion that you've got for the history of the organisation. It means so much to you, doesn't it?
It does. I've seen what a genuine difference that SIGINT makes to our country and to our partnerships with other agencies overseas and onto agencies in the UK. And it's been a privilege to work for the organisation for the length of time I have. But yeah, I'm taking over from Tony, and I've got some very big shoes to fill, because I've got a lot of respect for Tony. I've worked with him for many years on some of the military history sort of projects that I've been pursuing outside work.
Because you've written a couple of books, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Certainly the World War II era is just fascinating to me. But that period of time has to now expand to 100 years. So I've got to learn, you know, going back to the First World War right up to the present day. It's a big ask, but something I love a challenge, and I'm looking forward to taking on responsibility of the role.
That's something probably people won't realise. I'm guessing Dave will have to be involved with whatever's released next, won't he? So we're talking about Cold War by then, aren't we?
Yeah. I mean, we've started releasing Cold War intelligence reports. We started quite a few years ago to do that. But one of the consequences of publishing John Ferris's authorised history of GCHQ is that we promised that following on from publication of the book, we would do a release to complement the book, a release of the documents, yeah, as much as possible of the documents that John Ferris cites. And that's all going to happen under Dave's gaze.
So have you managed to get away with not doing that then?
It looks, as a complete byproduct of the book being late, that will be entirely Dave's business and not mine.
And I'm not going to pretend that I'm dreadfully unhappy about that.
So you're looking forward to that then, Dave?
Yes, the poison chalice is being passed across.
Tony, I mean, we've spoken about how much the organisation's changed for you while you've been here. How many years service will you have done by the end of your career?
By the time I finish, I've done 37 years.
And you started actually in operations, didn't you?
Exactly. This is my first ever non-operational job. So I've worked as a linguist. I've worked supporting the military. I was the UK rep on the NATO Signing Committee. You know, I've had a lot of deep operational experience, but I must admit, none of it has been as much fun, as challenging, or has given me as much personal satisfaction as doing this job. And working with you, working with the Bletchley Park Trust, has been an absolute highlight for me. I mean, where else have we had, until very recently, where we've been able to talk about the work of SIGIN? Where else have we been able to showcase things? And where else have we had volunteers who, in talking about the subject they're interested in, which is the history of Bletchley, 1939 to 1945, sounds a bit like a mastermind special subject, yeah, doesn't it? But think how much the people who are so passionate about Bletchley's history have done for us in telling SIGIN stories and making the work that happened at Bletchley Park come alive for so many visitors and so many people who read about it.
It would be easy for the general public to look at GCHQ as this big, scary organisation, you know, that are listening to everyone. Yeah. Now, any of us who understand the organisation realise it's not that. You're there just to protect us. But it's a good in for GCHQ to have had that history, isn't it?
It is. And remember something that goes right back to when you and I think, first knew each other, when Sir Ian Lobban, his speech at Leeds University during the Turing centenary. And one of the points that he made about GCHQ was that GCHQ isn't just a headquarters building in Cheltenham, and it's not just the National SIGINT organisation as defined in the Intelligence Services Act 1994.
Yeah.
It's also the sum of all of the people who work in SIGINT and all of the people who have worked in SIGINT. Yeah. It's our collective experience as well. And I think that's one of the things that makes it such a satisfying place to work, and perhaps a reassurance to people who do think it might be this big, scary spy organisation. How can all these tens of thousands of citizens, yeah, fellow citizens, have been some sort of crook or some sort, yeah, of master spies or some sort of surveillance freaks or anything like that? I know it's a cliche. It's ordinary people doing extraordinary work,
yeah,
but just because it's a cliche doesn't mean that it's not true. That's the bit of our history that I like to think I'm a part of. I'm a single part of it. I'm handing my part over to Dave. And in some years' time, Dave will hand over to someone else. And that thread just runs through the whole of our history, that we are fellow citizens whose job it is to protect our country and the people who live there.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, also, GCHQ can't be that scary and big brothery, because they let me in there, didn't they?
Yeah, but I suppose everybody makes a mistake from time to time.
Tony, can I just say, on behalf of the listeners and personally, thank you so much for everything that you've done for us, everything that you've done for GCHQ, and everything you've done for Bletchley Park as well. And on top of that, can I just say thank you for your service?
Thanks very much. You have moved me. It's not often that I am stuck for words, but you've managed it. Well done, Mark. Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.